Welcome to Eye to Eye, the podcast of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. My name is Sunil Mamtora, and I will be your host.
Welcome to a series of special episodes in lieu of the College Congress that would have been. In this second episode, Christina Rennie virtually chairs her session, Controversies in Diabetic Retinopathy. We then hear from authors of abstracts, which had been accepted for presentation as posters.
I thank everyone for joining me today. So I'm Christina Rennie. I'm a consultant ophthalmologist at University Hospital Southampton, and I'm a medical retina specialist. And I also have a role as a medical lead for safety in the hospital. And I'm really excited to welcome everyone today. I have with me Professor Farouk Ganshi, who's a consultant ophthalmologist and head of the ophthalmology services in Bradford. I have Robin Hamilton, who's director of medical retina service at Moorfields Eye Hospital. And Stella Vujosevic, who's head of the medical retina services at San Giuseppe Hospital in Milan. Now, we were originally supposed to be doing a session on controversies in diabetic retinopathy at the Congress next week. And it's very sad we can't be there. Obviously, the pandemic has changed everyone's plans. But I'm really delighted to have everyone here today for us to have a discussion about some aspects of diabetic retinopathy. Now, obviously, our original plans were to discuss the role of laser in the anti-VEGF era, when to use steroids, and whether biomarkers can help with when we make that decision, and what's coming on the horizon for diabetic retinopathy. However, at the moment, with COVID, our management of diabetic patients has changed dramatically, and so we're really only seeing those very high-risk patients at the moment, and the way we're managing patients is also changing rapidly. So what I want to do today is focus on how we're changing our services, what information that we have from those talks we were going to give that can influence what our decision making is now as to how we manage our patients during the COVID era. So what I thought I'd do to start with is just find out how things are for everyone at the moment. So Robin, can I start by just asking you, how are things at Moorfields and how have you adapted the service for patients with diabetic eye disease?
So at Moorfields at the moment, we are taking every step to maintain patient safety as we've been advised to do by the government on multiple occasions. And that's meant that we can only truly see our patients who are high risk. And when that comes to medical retina, the most high risk patients in the service are those patients with age-related macular degeneration or any choroidal neovascular membrane, such as those patients with myopia, angioid streaks, or other genetic or inflammatory causes. When it comes to the diabetes, again, we have chosen to treat our highest risk patients. And these include anybody with neovascularization of the iris or angle or neovascular glaucoma, and those patients with proliferative diabetic retinopathy. And we've included the patients with high risk proliferative diabetic retinopathy and some patients with the low risk proliferative diabetic retinopathy. We've also included any patients who we've recently treated. So it's a really to follow up the results of your treatments from the laser. We've deferred most of our other diabetics. We have injected a few of our patients with diabetic macular edema, and we felt it appropriate that this should be a consultant decision. So we've risk stratified all our patients, and essentially we've treated really the only eyes, or patients with bilateral disease with poor vision from bilateral diabetic macular edema. So those are the priorities for us. With the COVID settling down a little bit, we're now beginning to consider which other patients we can bring in, but maybe we'll discuss that a little bit later on.
Thank you. Farouk, what challenges have you been facing in Bradford? Have you had staff redeployed?
Yeah, I think more or less similar to what Robin said has happened in Moorfields. Our trust has been a little bit more proactive and set up a management structure, Gold Command, Silver Command, and Bronze Command, and we feed into the Silver Command from all the clinical subspecialties. So earlier on, the trust decided that we want to suspend all the routine surgeries to start with, so all the operations were cancelled, and subsequently, all the routine outpatients activity was suspended as well. As the pandemic grew a little bit more, we were advised to stop all the work except for the emergencies. We continued with some of our macular degeneration work because it's a separate unit that we have. Our trainees were retrained and redeployed on the medical wards. Our nursing staff were also pulled and they were appointed on the medical wards as required. And that continued for a while, at least 3 weeks that our trainees were away. So the consultants then had to act as registrars and be on call, manning the casualties and whatnot. As I mentioned, our macula clinic continued to deliver the age-related macular degeneration services, but the diabetic retinopathy patients were put on hold. The screening program is on the hold still. We got our trainees back a couple of weeks back, so we are trying to now reconvene the group again and start some of the services as we go forwards. And we'll talk about it, as Robin mentioned, further on.
Mm-hmm. And Stella, we've all heard a lot about things in Northern Italy and the challenges that you've had there from COVID. It's had a huge impact. How are things for you now, and what impact have you seen in the eye clinics?
As you know, we were the first to have the complete lockdown, and it meant really that every, let's say, routine job in the clinic was stopped, and all the colleagues and the nurses were transferred to the COVID yards. So we did really only emergencies. All the theaters were closed. So the patients, let's say for the first month, it was in March, were not seen anywhere, the ophthalmologic patients. Thereafter, we started, let's say, to organize and to see first with urgency the AMD patients, mostly from the medical retina point of view. And now we are already in the phase two, let's say. We have started the phase two, so now we are organizing and we have organized to see the patients, let's say, throughout all the day, morning and the afternoon, in order to guarantee, you know, the distance and not the crowding of the waiting rooms and of the offices. And also for the injections, we are now starting to treat also the diabetic patients, but as Robin said, only the urgent cases.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a point on Farouk's comments earlier. He talked about the screening program being closed down. And the interesting thing that we found is after the lockdown, we still had a large number of patients who had already been referred from the screening program. And what we did at this stage is we took a look at all the images. So we asked the screening program to send us all the images, and then we risk stratified those. And we found that 80% of those patients who were R3 from a screening program did not, in fact, have any neovascularization that needed intervention. So we didn't see those patients. We advised them to stay at home and stay isolated. But we saw the 20% of patients who did need intervention.
Yeah, that's interesting to hear. We've been very similar in Southampton. We have access to all the images from screening. We've been able to do the same.
I was just going to ask, so your screening programs have continued throughout the pandemic, or these were the historic referrals that came through?
So this is the historical data. Right. So there are a number of patients in the screening program who had already been seen, and we had not managed to fit them in. And as soon as the lockdown started, we then had a backlog. Yeah. And obviously the diabetic macular edemas, you don't need to see as a matter of urgency, but those patients with proliferative retinopathy, we felt it appropriate to have a look at the images that were sent to us and potentially treat those, give them advice and ask them to come back to the screening program as and when they reopened. And interestingly, we have noticed now that the North Central London and North West London sectors have reopened their screening programs to see only those patients they felt were high risk. So those pregnant diabetics, as well as those who had previously been R2 and on a short follow-up cycle, on a six-month leave follow-up cycle in the screening program.
So we have the similar, the images come into the hospital system, and one of our colleagues, the lead for the diabetic service, goes through those images and decides which patients need face-to-face, if any.
So it's really interesting. It sounds like we've all been managing our diabetic patients in a very similar way. I think, as you said, we're all now beginning to think about what happens in phase two. How do we begin to increase our workload? We've certainly been around our department with our 2 meter rule going, how many patients can we fit in? And our usual 200 patients that come through a morning or an afternoon has now become 40. So we're doing about 20% of our normal activity. And so we have to think very carefully about which patients should be in that 20%, because that's not just medical retina, that's all the different subspecialties. And although virtual clinics are going to, obviously something we can talk about, something that are interesting to help increase the workload, they still bring a footfall through the department. So I guess the question to you is, how are you going to prioritise what you'll see, which patients are you going to start seeing as you increase the workload? So Robin, do you want to start with a...
I think that's a really good question. And I think you've iterated one of the problems. How do you see 200 patients when you only have space for 40? And I'm very interested in Stella's comment earlier that she's seeing patients two sessions a day every day. At Moorfields, we realise the backlog across the trust is now somewhere in the region of 20,000 patients in the retina service alone. Space is obviously a big problem, and we don't foresee at this stage any expansion in the hospital. There's only so much space. We do have a lot of elements to the medical retina service which are fairly low risk. Or potentially a less risk than diabetes, for example. And that includes our genetics patients. Some of our Nevus follow-up patients could be deemed a slightly less risk. So those are slightly further down the pecking order. I don't like to use the phrase of pecking order, but you have to risk stratify these patients. And if you start somewhere with your coronary vascular membranes and your new vascular glaucoma at the top, then you have to move through. And in answer to your question, where are we? We're now looking at seeing, we were seeing some of our central retinal vein occlusions, particularly the ischemic ones. We're now beginning to see more of our central retinal vein occlusions starting from next week, and some more of our diabetics. And again, the stratification usually comes related to only seeing eye, better seeing eye, severe non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy associated with diabetic macular edema, and then a visual acuity risk stratification along with a comorbidity stratification. And at the end of the day, we'll only be offering patients to come to the hospital. We would still expect, based on the guidance from the government that still says the high-risk patients should remain isolated, we're expecting few to come. We're currently running at around a 30% DNA rate of our high-risk diabetics who we are phoning prior to their appointment to ask them whether they're coming in. These are the ones that still say they are coming in, and we're still getting a 30% DNA rate. So I think that's got to be taken into consideration. The patients will vote with their feet. But the bigger question is, what do we do with our 20,000 backlog, which we have now? And if we're still trying to see our patients with appropriate social distancing and safety, I don't know how we're going to do it. I've got a number of ideas, but that will probably mean cost, imaging kit, IT, and a lot of investment of time.
Mm-hmm. Stella, how are you looking at things in Italy?
Yeah, we are now seeing, let's say, in the last day, something a little bit less than 50% of patients, a little bit less. Obviously, at the entrance of the hospital, the body temperature is taken from all the people who are entering, and just the patient can enter, not the family members, unless it is a child, obviously. So then we are, as the doctors and all the nurses in the offices, we have the masks FPP2 for the protection, not just the surgical. And also we have the shields, not the shields, for the breath and everything. So we try really, and we always clean after each, obviously, clean everything after each patient, trying to have our windows open, because at least now in Italy we have a good weather, let's say, so it's not cold. So just, you know, all these simple things, but in order to try to minimize as possible with always the, you know, with the gloves and always with the alcohol, disinfection. So at least this is in the office that we are trying to minimize any risk for the infection and the transmission, any possible transmission of these patients. Obviously, the patients that now started to go to the theater, the surgical, they always do the tamponade, testing for COVID. Yeah, they do the testing for COVID 24 hours before, and then we get it in the evening before the surgery. So obviously, if they are positive, they cannot enter the hospital. So these are some of the measures that we have adapted, let's say. And all the personnel is tested for the serology, not just the testing for COVID, but also serology if we have anything, EGM and EGG.
So we did some antigen testing for the staff a couple of weeks ago. And we found anything from 2 to 3% of our staff asymptomatic were positive, which is fairly small numbers, but it's not zero. And that's the antigen test. We're not offering yet the antibody test, but it's certainly been a conversation. Should we be offering, as Stella says, an antigen test or an antibody test to our patients? Probably an antigen test would be most appropriate, either the day before and potentially a week before as well, so that if they're positive a week before, then you can probably better judge how many patients are going to be coming into the service. But as Stella rightly says, I think at some point we're going to have to check all our staff for antibodies and antigen on a daily or weekly basis. And there's something that we don't know yet is if you are antibody positive, if you are IgG positive, does it stay positive for any length of time? So is it still positive at 3 months or 6 months or a year, which I'm sure we would love to know, and we would love it to be positive for the next 5 years, but we don't know that yet.
They're beginning to start offering the test for the staff, but not large scale yet.
And I guess we also don't know what immunity that gives us yet either. So the one thing we will mention is that we're seeing our high-risk patients with proliferative diabetic retinopathy. We're still offering laser treatment for these patients, but as you said, many are very reluctant to come in. Robin, what do you think the role is for anti-VEGF treatments in this situation?
I think that's a really good question, and I think we should all answer that question. We, as a service, discussed this at length, and we thought if it's going to be a big peak, we could get our patients with proliferative retinopathy, give them one injection of anti-VEGF or two injections of anti-VEGF, and then put them through a 20-minute PRP, or however long it would take. Now, of course, it would take longer if you are wearing appropriate PPE and the patient has a mask, because your eyepieces will steam up. The whole process just takes longer. So in fact, the chair time, if you're doing a laser, puts the patient at risk, and puts the patient at risk and puts the doctor at risk. So it's not to be taken lightly. But I think if you look at some of the data from Protocol S, Rise and Ride and Clarity, even with monthly injections on Rise and Ride, there were still quite a lot of patients who were proliferative at the end of the study and became proliferative at the end of the study. If you look at the Protocol S, for example, in the first 6 months, about a third or just over a third, a lot of patients it resolved, the neovascularization resolved, but a third of patients was just simply stable, and 8% at 6 months had got worse. And that increases at the end of 2 years to be nearly, well, over a quarter of patients were worse at the end of 2 years, so had more proliferative retinopathy. So it's not really an answer. The Clarity study for aflibercept probably showed a little bit better. And 18% had reactivated by the end of the year. A lot of stability. Only 2% had rescue laser at the end of that first year, which is a small number. But it's not really the answer. And at the end of the day, you want to get your patients in and give them definitive laser. So the way that we have run this is we've been offering our patients continue to come in and have the treatment and have ideally one sitting of laser. And with a short duration pattern laser, you can usually get a good laser on with one sitting with minimal side effects. So that's what we've been offering, and that's what we felt was most appropriate. But safety is important. The appropriate PPE is important. So that's the way we're doing it at the moment.
And Stella, how have you been managing your proliferative patients?
We are treating them with PRP mostly because at some point, especially at the beginning of this emergency, we stopped all the surgeries. Let's say we are doing the injections in the theaters still, so we stopped it. Now that we started again, at least obviously for the proliferative, we try to do at least one injections. For DME, we try to, let's say, not to do the PRN anymore because we don't want to see the patients anymore, but just to do it like a fixed regimen or extend. So just to make the appointments for the injections.
So the one thing a lot of you mentioned is that getting the right PPE, particularly for doing laser when you're spending so long close to the patient. What would you recommend as being appropriate precautions to take when doing laser treatment? So Robin, do you have a comment on that?
So we started using the surgical masks for the doctor only. That rapidly changed into a surgical mask for the doctor and for the patient. We didn't feel it appropriate that to get the full PPE for the laser because it's very hard to be wearing the full PPE in a laser room. The FFP2 masks are probably more appropriate than a simple surgical mask, but we have had a lot of difficulty in accessing the appropriate masks and getting the FFP2 masks that actually fit. We find that we have to fit test the FFP2 and the FFP3 masks at the moment. And we have had a lot of trouble getting hold of both of those in sufficient numbers to be able to for us to comfortably do laser with those. The college guidance still remains just as an FFP1 mask with surgical mask, which may well be sufficient, probably not ideal, but may well be sufficient. And that's the current guidance, so that's what we are using.
Is anyone else doing anything different to that?
Along the similar lines, we had, however, suspended all the treatments for a while, and we're recommencing that. And the concern around the PRP remains that you are in a confined room, in a small room with a patient in a close proximity, and the risk of contact cross-infection, both for the patient and the operator, is significant in that environment. And we need to be absolutely sure that we are protecting our staff and the patient as much as we can. Our colleagues are keen to keep on using anti-VEGF as a temporary measure so as to find and buy some time while we're trying to get the PRPs done. But as Robin mentioned, I don't think that is a permanent fix, and we got to have the PRP, access to PRP. One of the options that we have considered is for some patients, at least, we may be able to offer indirect laser. That's where you have slightly more distance between the operator and the patient, something that we have been considering at the moment.
I have to say in Southampton, we've been fortunate to have FFP3 masks. I think when we're doing prolonged procedures on the slit lamp or in the laser, I guess there have been a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of debate about this, and there have been a lot of nervousness about spending prolonged time, you know, close to the patient for risk to the surgeon or to the patient. But again, like Robin says, it's been difficult to always have, you know, have enough supply of the FFP3 masks, getting everyone fit tested. Sometimes you have some masks in stock and not the ones that might be your mask. So it's an ongoing discussion as to what will happen with that going forward. So just moving on a little bit, you know, we've been looking at talking about proliferative patients, but also we have lots and lots of patients with diabetic macular edema, a majority of whom will be postponed by 3 or 4 months. And that 3 months will very soon be up. So we have to think a little bit about what happens to these patients going forward. You know, are we going to be able to manage increasing our workload to take them on? What's the risk for that group of patients? So, Stella, what are your thoughts about this group of patients, and what are the risks if we're delaying the treatment for them?
For DME patients, I think the DME patients are definitely... this is the population, let's say, that compared to the AMD patient, can wait a little bit longer, but not too much longer. And here we have also the possibility to have another type of drugs for DME treatment, so the steroids, not only the anti-VEGF that maybe need, let's say, monthly injections. So, for example, the steroids can be a good option in order just, you know, to do the treatment, and then the patient is okay for 3 to 4 months. Obviously, the patient will need at least one check of the IOP, but this can be done, let's say, to his local ophthalmologist, or I don't know, in UK, maybe you are organized differently than we are in Italy, because IOP is always checked by the ophthalmologist, but the patient does not need to come to the big hospital and, you know, to make a crowd and be, you know, with a lot of other patients. So it is definitely a good option. Obviously, in young patients, phakic patients, DME with proliferative retinopathy, anti-VEGF still remain, obviously, the first choice treatment. So in those cases, at least you can, I would say, start with some fixed dose treatment without any controls in the meantime.
And Stella, you were going to talk to us originally about biomarkers as well. Are there any particular biomarkers that might help you make that decision as to whether you would carry on with anti-VEGFs or think about steroids in your patients with DME?
Yes, this is a good question. Obviously, the biomarkers of inflammation are those that I'm usually looking at on OCT, for example, OCT or OCTA. And here there are several signs or several biomarkers that we can see. The ones are, for example, some specific patterns of edema, such as the diabetic macular edema with subfoveal neuroretinal detachment that show to have some higher concentrations of cytokines and interleukins, some specific interleukins in the aqueous humor and vitreous, or for example the presence of these tiny hyperreflective retinal spots as the signs of the activation of the microglial cells. The drill, the disorganization of the inner retinal layers is more as the biomarker of the neurodegeneration of the retina, and it has been seen that when treated with steroids, it can even decrease this the drill extension in the retina, whereas the anti-VEGF, as we know, they don't have this, neuroprotective effect, obviously. So maybe if we have a lot of neurodegenerative damage in the retina, then maybe the steroids might be more appropriate in our patients. So definitely in these cases now of emergency, all of these signs can indicate more steroid treatment than the anti-VEGF treatment.
Robin, do you have any comments about the role of steroids?
Again, there were multiple discussions about switching patients onto a steroid for a period of time during the COVID, current COVID or post-COVID or peri-COVID period that we're probably in now. And initially we felt, don't bring the patients in, which was appropriate. We still feel we made the right decision there. Moving forwards, if we want to consider covering our patients' diabetic macular edema for any period of time of 3 months or even up to 6 months, it may be appropriate to give steroid. Some patients will obviously be phakic, and there is an ongoing risk associated with steroids in phakic patients. And also we have to consider what happens on the other side, whether people will be continuing with the steroid or be switching back to anti-VEGF. I feel our commissioners would be fairly lenient on us if we did feel we needed to switch from one to the other and back again, although they haven't been fairly that vocal with us with that respect, although they have been, it has been broached on a number of occasions. But there are other risks associated with steroids, such as raised intraocular pressure, which may mean multiple visits to the hospital, which may defeat the object of the exercise. So in a vast majority of our patients, although we have offered, we've recommended keeping with the anti-VEGF when they come back in.
And Farouk, what have your practice been up in Bradford?
It's similar to what Robin says. We would continue with the ongoing anti-VEGF injections the best we can. Steroids, of course, gives an option for some patients where it is suitable to see them if the patient accepts the risks of the steroid injections, offer it, and then prolong the interval between the visits in the clinic. That is possible, but again, that needs to be taken into account only when the patient or the systems does not allow for the anti-VEGF injections to be continued. I'm sure there is a role for that, but jumping onto steroids directly is probably not the best answer here.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Ron. So the other thing, actually, Farouk, talking to you, you were going to talk to us about what was on the horizon for treatment of diabetic retinopathy. Is there anything you think coming up that would make a big difference to how we manage things, particularly in this post-COVID era?
Oh, certainly. It's been a very exciting field for development of new therapeutic options for the diabetic macular edema in particular and diabetes in general. COVID pandemic itself, to some extent, has affected the research up and down the country and across the globe. And there's going to be some delay in access to some of these molecules which would become available. So if I can focus on the things that are likely to be available soonish, then probably brolucizumab is likely to be the one that may be available in the next year or so for the diabetic macular edema indication. It's already been licensed for AMD, as we know. And the potential there is that we'll have a longer intervals between the visits and fewer injections for the patients. Similarly, the Tie2 receptor has been another exciting field of development. Tie2 receptor, Ang2 inhibition in particular, can help stabilize the blood retinal barrier. And the faricizumab is the molecule here. But that research is again likely to be delayed. But that would be another molecule that may be available over the next year or so. Another exciting development is the port delivery system. Now that is going to be available soonish, certainly for the macular degeneration. But if it was available now, we can imagine a number of our macular edema patients could have had that sort of device, and we could have left them with that in the eye and not needing to see them for a period of time. There are plenty of other things that we can talk about, but with the limitation of time that we have, I think suffice it to say, pandemic is going to affect the research and would delay some of the exciting things that would become available to us in future.
So, Robin, I had a question for you, actually, just going back, thinking about other treatments and laser. What do you think about the role of things like the micropulse laser?
Christina, thanks for asking that. So the micropulse laser has certainly shown a lot of promise in the treatment for macular edema. As you are aware, there is an ongoing study looking at its direct comparator, which is the standard focal macular laser that we currently use, and that's the Diamond study. That is coming towards its conclusion from year two, so we should get some data on that. But I think the micropulse does have some potential benefits, but time will tell, and I would not like to give any further data or information until we get the results from Diamonds. One other consideration, Christina, which we have talked about in the past, is whether pan-retinal photocoagulation will reduce the risk of diabetic macular edema and indeed potentially reduce the number of injections for diabetic macular edema. And really, there are two studies which look at targeted PRP for this indication to see if you can reduce the number of injections. One which was reported by James Talks, and the other is the DAVE trial, which I believe was reported by Dave Brown from the US. And in both of those studies, it did not show any benefits or any reduction in injections in diabetic macular edema with adjunctive pan-retinal photocoagulation. I suppose it's also worth considering the protocol I and the deferred laser alongside these injections to consider if there's any benefit or any reduction in the number of injections needed. And at the end of the day, I feel that putting someone in front of laser and an injection, either initially or even after 3 months, does not show any benefits for these patients, particularly during the COVID era.
Thank you very much. Has anyone got anything else they want to add to our Stella?
Yeah, about the micropulse laser in the COVID era, I agree that there is very limited role of the micropulse laser in the COVID era, because the micropulse laser is indicated in very mild diabetic macular edema. I'm doing a lot of micropulse lasers, but in very mild edema. And these patients are those that in protocol we, let's say, were not treated for in this sense. They have a very good visual acuity and very initial edema. So it is a treatment option, but with not, let's say, so high risk, at least in these limited times, we hope, everyone, I think, of the pandemic era. So these patients need eventually, as Farouk said, we would need some longer lasting drugs in the context of the anti-VEGF drugs, okay, in that class of drugs. Or then if patients had some specific characteristics, they can also have steroids as a longer lasting drugs.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned the protocol V, because I think that for me makes me feel very comfortable when we start saying the patients we can leave. And actually, it's very much about a management plan, isn't it? That we don't have to jump in and treat until people's vision is beginning to drop. So I think that makes us all feel very comfortable that you see those results at 2 years are very similar, whether they were having treatment or if you wait until they begin to deteriorate. So I think that for a lot of us makes us feel very comfortable about letting those patients with mild macular edema wait. And that's a good thing to have during the pandemic. And nice information to be able to share with patients, say actually there is an evidence that says you're unlikely to come to harm by waiting.
Yeah, we agree, all of us.
That's a good Has anyone else got anything they'd like to contribute? I think we've had a really interesting discussion. I'd like to thank you all very, very much for taking part.
If I can, it's planning about the future services. Because of the social distancing issues, we're all going to struggle with the accommodation. What we have been fortunate here in Bradford with is the School of Optometry. And as you know, the universities are not on at the moment, and they have a clinical space which they have very kindly offered that we can use for some of the patients. We are exploring that options so we can transfer some of the activity, outpatient activity, in the School of Optometry, where they have the clinical facility, all the scanning equipment and slit lamps and whatnot. So we can space out some of the patients there. That would open up more space and some capacity for the patients who need to be in the acute hospital environment. And additionally, we are also following with the continued practice of teleconferencing and video conferencing where we can. Virtual clinics have already been mentioned, and that should help planning going forwards. Still, a long way to go, though.
Yeah, I agree with that. Now, what I was going to say, Farouk, I wonder if you've had any discussion with your screening program about extending their role in your virtual clinics. And wonder whether we should be looking at this from a national point of view and extending out our R0s and our R1s to 2 years and increasing the amount of virtual work done within the screening program so they can see their R2s on a 6-monthly basis. They could see our low-risk R3s or our severe or very severe NPDRs on a 3-monthly basis, and they could run it through a screening program rather than running it through the hospital. One of you had any thoughts on that?
No, sure. As you know, the screening programs have changed in how they manage and whatnot. So my colleague who is leading on the DESP has been in discussion with the powers to be of the local screening program. The option of having OCT embedded within the screening program has been discussed. It's been discussed for a long while, but because of lack of funding, it's still not available. And making that sort of thing available in the community would take us further down the road that you are charting here now. But yes, that is something that we need to explore both locally and nationally through the DESP Central.
I must contribute to that. I think it would be very helpful to have something come centrally. I've certainly started some conversations with our commissioners locally to say, actually, what can we do? I think there's some very low-risk patients sit with us that our screening program can pick up, absolutely. So we have an R1M1 imaging clinic, and they're now about to get an OCT. And I think those can go lock, stock and barrel to their new R1M1 clinic and pick up those patients. But equally, I think there are a lot of low-risk patients that they could screen for us. We don't have the capacity or the space now with the reduced footfall through the department to do all the imaging. So if they would, even if we read the images ourselves, if they did the imaging, we could then look at that and make clinical decisions based on that. They don't necessarily need to do all the decision making, but it would certainly take a lot of work out of the department. So I think it could be a really helpful way for us to come out the other side of the pandemic by getting some of this work moved outside.
It needs to, yes.
Stella, do you have that kind of option? Do you have an option to do any sort of other screening outside of your... I think you mentioned that you have general ophthalmologists that feed in. Will they be doing some of the screening for you, and can you extend some of their screening and ask them to send images to you?
Yeah, now we are in Italy trying to organize this kind of service, let's say, to the patients, to try to organize some kind of screening outside from the hospital, definitely. From the time being, for example, we are calling all our patients, asking them what is the vision, if they had any urgent problem or something like that. So now, let's say, this kind of screening, pre-screening is done in order to say, please come to the hospital immediately. Otherwise, if the patients are stable, I'm talking about DME patients or diabetic patients, then they are postponed. They are still postponed. But that would be, I'm always citing the UK screening program, that it would be really something very important to have on a national level. I'm always telling it on every meeting in Italy. But yeah, unfortunately, we have it just in some spot-like hospitals or some places, very singular, but not on a national level. But it would be something definitely useful.
Mm.
Okay, well, can I say a very big thank you to you all for taking part in the podcast. It's been really enjoyable having this discussion with you this afternoon. And hopefully another year we might see you all in person.
Thank you.
Let's hope so.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Christina. Take care. Thank you, Christina.
Well, that was really interesting, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Now for some interviews with abstract authors. I'm joined by Ketan Kapoor, a hospital optometrist who works at the Royal United Hospital in Bath. He's talking to me today about his work, entitled A Clinical Audit of an Optometrist-Led Rapid Access Wet AMD Referral Clinic. So thank you very much, Ketan, for joining me today to talk about your work. Could you tell the listeners a bit about your study?
Hi, Sunil. So what we had intended to do with our audit was look at ourselves as optometrists seeing patients referred in with suspected wet AMD and compare our clinical findings to those of the consultant ophthalmologist. Essentially, what had happened was we found that there was a gap in the service. One of the consultant ophthalmologists who was specialising in medical retina was going on maternity leave, and in order to fill that gap, we decided as optometrists that with appropriate training from the consultants that we were safe to see these patients and clinically assess them and decide on which route through the pathway they would follow. We compiled a spreadsheet of the 100 patients who were first seen in the service and then analysed the results.
Okay, and what were the results?
So what we had found is that actually our results were quite concordant with the consultant ophthalmologists. So within the ophthalmologists group, 84% of the patients that had been referred were not listed for fluorescein angiography. In our cohort, 74% of patients were not listed, and within the ophthalmologist group, they proceeded with FFA for 16% of patients. We proceeded to carry out FFA for 26% of our patients.
Okay, so, I mean, that sounds reasonably comparable.
Indeed, yes.
Okay, so it sounds as though, you know, in this situation, in keeping with probably other units across the country, that you've had a situation where hospital optometrists are really taking away some of the role of the ophthalmologist and doing a great job with it, and also, you know, providing a safe and effective service.
Yep, definitely. And what we were hoping is that this would continue on even after the consultant ophthalmologist returned from maternity leave, and that's indeed what has happened. And not only did we feel as optometrists that this was a good use of our time, but other colleagues agreed, nursing staff, doctors, and I think even the patients felt that they were receiving a good quality service.
Okay. So, you know, looking at the actual referrals you receive from community optometry,
yeah,
what proportion of them were actually positive for having wet AMD?
So within the group that we analysed, we had 27% of patients who were positive for treatable wet AMD. And I think that's in line with other audits that have been carried out across the country.
Okay, I mean, to me, having a positive rate of referral for wet AMD is 27%
seems quite low. Do you know if that's changed over the years?
I think it's something that is improving, but still one of the main problems is in the community is if the practitioner doesn't have access to an OCT, it's difficult for them to really be certain whether to refer or not to refer. And so we found that a lot of the false positive referrals that we had received were those practitioners who were referring without the benefit of OCT. And that's something that I would imagine now is reducing with the rollout of OCT in the community.
So it sounds as though you've had a fairly successful intervention in terms of improving the quality and efficiency of the service that you're working in. You know, what are your visions for further improving the efficiency and quality of your service, especially given the times of COVID-19?
So one of the key outcomes of this audit was that we delivered the results of the audit to optometrists in a training event. And during that event, we had interaction with them. We introduced them to the consultant ophthalmologists and really tried to foster links between the community and ourselves in order to improve the relationship. And we have a service now where the optometrist and the community, if they're uncertain of whether their patient needs to be referred, they can email in their scans and clinical queries and we can respond to that. Another way in which we're hoping to improve on the service is at the moment we have the capability of carrying out OCT angiography rather than fluorescein angiography. And with the current pandemic as well, I think that's something that will definitely help in order to really speed up the process of the patient along the pathway, clarifying whether they are eligible for treatment and then proceeding with the first injection. As you might know, the current NICE guidance recommends that patients with suspected active wet AMD receive treatment within 14 days of their referral. And we had found that actually proceeding with fluorescein angiography did lengthen that time in some cases.
Okay, just one final question, if that's okay. So once the optometrist and the hospital has provisionally diagnosed the patient with wet AMD, are they able to list the patient directly for injections, or are they then referred on to the ophthalmologist?
So at the moment, our protocol is if we suspect the patient has wet AMD and they're within treatment criteria, is to proceed with fluorescein angiography before they then proceed with their first injection in order to clarify which type of CNV there might be and for the consultant to decide which type of anti-VEGF treatment they would prefer for that patient to receive.
Okay, well, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Sunil.
I'm now joined by Maryam Islam, a trainee from Moorfields Eye Hospital. She's talking to me today about her work, home monitoring for patients with diabetic macular edema, My Doctor Knows How I'm Seeing Every Day. So Maryam, thank you very much for joining me to talk today. Could you tell us a bit about your study?
Well, thank you for having me, Sunil. So our work involves the use of home monitoring of metamorphopsia in patients with diabetic macular disease using a novel smartphone application that's CE marked and FDA cleared for the quantification of this remotely. So essentially what we have done is we've approached patients who normally attend injection clinics in the medical retina clinics in Moorfield South in Croydon, and we've asked them to complete essentially a hyperacuity alignment task, which is very simple to do that they can perform at home. And this gives them a score which corresponds to their level of visual distortion, which the hospital specialists are able to see remotely, and then essentially identify whether their vision appears to be stable, whether it's deteriorating, and they might need a sooner intervention in terms of injection therapy than might be anticipated.
Okay, and so you mentioned there that it's a simple to use application. Do all patients find it easy to use?
On the whole, from the feedback that I have received, because with the work that we've currently done, I have been contacting patients every few weeks to see whether they run into any issues. Most of the patients do find it relatively simple to perform, including those patients who are elderly, who on sort of first glance you might anticipate might struggle with it. But I think that's a really important thing to caution against, because a lot of our patients who are elderly are very au fait with technology. And of course, not everyone necessarily owns a smartphone, but those who express a degree of interest can learn how to perform the test relatively quickly and very much enjoy doing so on a regular basis. It provides them with sort of a form of entertainment, and lots of them have said that they feel like it's a bit of a game.
Okay, that's really interesting. And how much does this app cost?
So the app itself is free to download. Anyone can download it. However, At Moorfields, we have a number of licenses, so we provide patients with codes which essentially can be entered into the application, which allow the app to connect to our cloud-based system so that we can see their scores remotely. So you could go and download it now from the App Store, but we wouldn't necessarily be able to see your scores because we've not connected to you. But there is no fee per patient.
Ah, that's very interesting. I feel like maybe I should download the app myself and have a play with it. It sounds really interesting.
You should have a play with it, but as long as you're not prone to health anxiety. But I'm sure you'll do very well with the scores.
I would hope so, yeah. So, you know, obviously you submitted this abstract, you know, way before COVID time. But, you know, with what you're saying about this app being an objective way to quantify metamorphopsia, do you think that it's got any particular relevance in perhaps reducing the number of hospital visits during COVID time?
Well, certainly, absolutely. So as you say, we did all this work well before COVID was even you know, something that any of us knew about. But it was something that was spurred on initially by the fact that, you know, ophthalmology is now the busiest outpatient specialty in the UK, and we've got 1,500 ophthalmologists. We've got 1,500 ophthalmologists propping up our service, and diabetes also places a significant burden on this. And well before this, we knew that the ophthalmology service was snowed under, and we needed to find a way for us to identify the patients who need a review to ensure that we see the right patient at the right time. Even more so now with COVID, in this time where we're trying to reduce face-to-face interactions of our patients, if we could have a way, using the app, of understanding the degree of disease activity and the level of metamorphopsia of these patients remotely, we would be able to do two things. We would be able to identify those who needed review earlier, i.e. their scores are deteriorating to what we would deem a significant level, which would warrant a further review face-to-face to make sure that you're only bringing in those who truly require that therapy in order to stabilise their vision. But conversely, you'd be able to identify those who are stable, and from that you would be able to reassure patients and let them know that they don't need to come in, which is certainly something that many of our patients want to hear at the moment. But not only does it alleviate the service, but it also provides patients with an immediate feedback and reassurance mechanism and a direct line of communication to access us should they feel that they need to.
That's really interesting. And, you know, your study looked at patients who had diabetic macular edema, but potentially do you think you could use this, you know, in patients with wet AMD? Maybe on those who are on PRN regimens, it would mean that you could only bring them in for an injection where they needed it, rather than bringing them in for repeated OCT visits.
Absolutely, and I think it has huge relevance there. The app itself was first demonstrated as a study in AMD patients, in actual fact, and so this is the first work that we've done in DMO following on from that. But it has applicability in any patient who has macular disease and then subsequently develops a degree of metamorphopsia. And in this current time with COVID, it is actually something that we're pursuing further at Moorfields. Certainly in Croydon at the moment, we are offering the use of the app to all of our low and medium risk patients who have been triaged, i.e. won't be seeing a doctor face-to-face for 6 months. We're in the process of calling all of these patients and offering them the opportunity to be involved and to use this remotely to really help us identify and ensure that we're not, you know, missing these patients who need intervention. Of course, risk stratification exists for a reason, and we understand that these patients, you know, on the whole, we feel that, you know, DMO patients or certain low-risk AMD patients who've been stable for a very long time are unlikely to deteriorate, but there are always exceptions to the rule. And certainly there's a huge potential for applicability in these patients who are PRN, so that we could essentially identify a pattern. If there was a patient that you have who has wet AMD and you know have been fairly stable on a PRN regime, and you could reproduce that the all-eye generates an alarm at a certain period of time, you could bring that patient in and only do the injection when it was required. And that's hugely important at this time when we have these who are mostly very high-risk patients. Our elderly population is predominantly our AMD population, and we really need to safeguard their health. And this is a really powerful way to do this. And certainly we hope it's something that will have immediate applicability and can be translated in this really unusual time.
So tell me about your results.
So in terms of our results, so our interim analysis was performed in March of this year, and this was when we had our first data for a 3-month follow-up, and we looked at 65 eyes of 33 patients. It's important to say that we were looking at, as you know, only DMO patients. They had to have a minimum visual acuity of 624, which allows them to actually be able to perform the test. What we found was many patients conducted the test on a number of times. So we found that people continue to use the app, which is the main important thing. Adherence is what is really important. You can come up with what you think is a brilliant idea, but what you need to know is, do people like it? And also, do they keep using it? So we have very good feedback from our patients on from our telephone calls that they felt that it was simple to use. But the main issue that they came across is that they forgot to use it. Therefore, we implemented reminders via the app. So patients get reminded if they don't do a test every 48 hours, and that pops up on their phone. Subsequent to that, the number of tests that we found that people were doing did increase. But what was really important and interesting was really a trend that those who did develop what we call an all-eye alarm, that is that they get three consecutive what we'd call red scores, i.e. a significant deterioration in their vision, those people who generated an alarm, at their subsequent follow-up visit, their visual acuity was 5.8 fewer letters. So there's potential here, although we have a relatively small number of eyes in obviously what is a very small pilot study, there's a trend towards this indicating that their visual acuity does decline, so that there's a correlation here with their subsequent visual acuity. Now, of course, you can say that, you know, metamorphopsy doesn't translate absolutely to visual acuity, and I absolutely agree, but that is currently what we do, and we bring people back to clinic, we look at their LogMAR, we look at their Snellen, and that's our current system in place, so that's what we had to compare to.
So one last question, if that's okay. I think, you know, you touched on it there that, you know, visual acuity is really important, and, you know, metamorphopsia and, you know, macular OCT findings only tell part of the story. Did you measure the visual acuity for patients in the study when they were at home, or do you have any plans to look at that data?
So measuring visual acuity at home is certainly the holy grail of what we would all like to achieve, particularly in the current time with all of the attend anywhere visual consultations that are happening. In this study, we didn't look at home visual acuity because, as far as I understand it, we don't have a reliable way of doing so. I gather that there are groups, including Peter Thomas's group at Moorfields, who are looking at ways of doing this at home, involving sending people visual acuity tests to perform in advance of their appointment. But at the moment, as far as I understand it, there's no ideal validated way to do this.
Okay, well, thank you very much for speaking with me. That was really interesting.
Thank you for having me.
I'm now speaking with Aidan Benson, a trainee who works at the Leeds Teaching Hospital Foundation Trust, and his abstract is entitled Ocular Surface Side Effects of Novel Biologic Agent for the Treatment of Eczema, Dupilumab, Real-World Data from the UK Cohort. Aidan, thanks a lot for speaking with me today. Before we actually talk about your study, I was wondering if you could explain to the listeners what exactly is dupilumab and what are the associated ocular side effects?
Yeah, hi, Sunil. Dupilumab is anti-interleukin-4 and 13 monoclonal antibody, which has been used sort of since about 2017 by mainly dermatologists for allergic skin disorders, but it's also been used in sort of asthma and some sinus conditions. So as sort of outside of studies, it's now being used more and more. And I think as a result of that, we're seeing more and more patients in eye clinics. So that was sort of what triggered us to do the study.
That is really interesting. And actually, personally, I have also been seeing quite a few patients referred by the dermatologists who are taking this drug as well. So could you tell us a bit about your study?
Yeah, well, all we did was, it was a sort of retrospective study looking at all of the patients, because we were collaborating with the dermatology department, who had a good database of everyone that they'd started on dupilumab. And they were one of the early adopters in the UK, so they had a good patient number. We looked at all the patients that had been started on it, and then we looked at both their dermatology documentation on the electronic patient record and the ophthalmology electronic patient record to sort of tie up which of those patients had ended up in the ophthalmology department with problems. So sort of, if anything, we were sort of underreporting the number of people, because there's theoretically some people we would have missed. But it was useful for us to sort of get an idea on a sort of real world level of, you know, these are all the people we started on the drug in dermatology, how many of them developed eye problems, because that had been sort of mentioned in the literature, but we didn't have an idea in the UK sort of how many people that actually was.
Okay, and what proportion of patients who had been initiated on dupilumab were you actually seeing in the eye clinic?
Well, that was a surprise for us. We knew that we'd seen a few sort of on each eye casualty, but, you know, we hadn't realized how many it was. And actually looking at the numbers, I mean, it was up to 12% of the patients who'd been started on it had seen an ophthalmologist and then were deemed to have enough ocular inflammation to require steroid treatment at that point, which was really, you know, that's not just the dry eye phenotype that had been seen and treated previously in the other papers, whereas actually a significant portion that were requiring steroid treatment for a fairly inflammatory condition, which was, you know, a big surprise for us.
And in your centre, you know, did you have a specific protocol or regimen for treating these patients?
There was a fair mix. It sort of depended on what the patients had had already, because some of them had already tried a lot of lubricants, in which case we'd just move up to some steroid treatment. Some patients were already on protopic or tacrolimus ointments for their skin, and that's quite effective in the eye itself. So then sometimes the treating ophthalmologist would say, well, just use some of the tacrolimus in your eye. And certainly a lot of the patients did very well long-term on a combination of steroids for the acute sort of phase, and then long-term maintenance on topical cyclosporine or Ikrivis in the UK, and they did, the vast majority of those did very well. Interestingly, we said that four patients had stopped treatment because of their side effects, but actually two of those four patients didn't actually have particularly severe disease as diagnosed by an ophthalmologist. So it wasn't, the stopping of it wasn't necessarily correlated with the severity of the disease that people had.
That's really interesting, yeah. And you, just one final question. I was wondering, you know, 12% of the cohort is quite significant. Do you know if there are any factors that may predict which patients develop ocular side effects?
Well, there were a few studies about that that sort of suggested that those with more severe atopic dermatitis were more likely to develop problems. But actually, when we looked through our group, I mean, we didn't mention this in the study because we weren't really looking at that, but the people who did badly weren't actually necessarily the most severe. And indeed, the people who had the most severe eye disease and most severe skin disease actually tended to do quite well with dupilumab. Some of them had corneal melts and things like this that were treated acutely with dupilumab, and they actually did very well, which was, again, a surprise for us, that the people who tended to get the severe disease were, as far as we can tell, I mean, this study doesn't really tell you, but it doesn't correlate necessarily with the severity of their skin disease, although other studies had found that.
Yeah, well, that's really fascinating and definitely something to look out for in the clinic. Thank you very much for your time today.
No, thank you. Good to speak to you.
That's the end of our second episode of Content from College Congress. There'll be more to come later as the week goes by. As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to get involved, talk about your work, or have any feedback, send us a message at communications@rcops.ac.uk.